KXSI 99.5 FM in New York. Llegar mis hermanos emplumados eran los hombres barbados de la profecía esperada. Se oyó la voz del monarca de que el Dios había llegado y les abrimos la puerta por temor a lo ignorado. Iban montados en bestias como demonios del mal, iban con fuego en las manos y cubiertos de metal. Solo el valor de unos cuantos les opuso resistencia y al mirar correr la sangre se llenaron de vergüenza. Porque los dioses ni comen ni gozan con lo robado, y cuando nos dimos cuenta ya todo estaba acabado. Y en ese error entregamos la grandeza del pasado, y en ese error nos quedamos 300 años esclavos. Se nos quedó el maleficio de brindar al extranjero nuestra fe, nuestra cultura, nuestro pan, nuestro dinero. Y hoy le seguimos cambiando oro por cuentas de vidrio y damos nuestra riqueza.
Good afternoon to our listeners at WBAI. Today is Sunday, August the 25th, 2019. It is 2:02 and you are listening to Voices of Resistance at WBAI.
It's 1:02. We are at the early time.
1:02! We started. Oh wow, you see that? You see that? This is Linda. We're gonna make Linda responsible because she switched the hour for us. Today we are meeting an hour earlier. So welcome. We hope that people were able to actually see the announcement we made about our program being on 1 hour earlier. 1 o'clock. 1:03 now. And you're listening to Voices of Resistance at WBAI 99.5 FM, New York. My name is Lucy Paguada Quesada. I am a teacher, human rights defender, political and social activist, and I am also the official coordinator of the Libre Party, which is the political arm of the Honduran Resistance, coordinated in Honduras by President Manuel Zelaya. And we know President Zelaya was overthrown from power via a U.S.-backed coup in 2009, under the administration of President Barack Obama and his then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. And today I am joined always by...
Hello, everybody. This is Andrea Vizeo. I am a mother, an educator, also political and social activist, also known as a troublemaker, and in Spanish, a callejera. and I stand for the freedom of President Lula, who is a political prisoner in Brazil, for the return of democracy in Brazil, and right now for the crisis in the Amazon, which is a world crisis.
Lula Libre and Fuera Jo. And today we have a special program like we always do, always under the line of U.S. imperialist attacks on Latin America. And we're going to have a focus on what is going on in these particular countries, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. And we are going to be analyzing the impact of the economic sanctions against Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, looking at U.S. economic asphyxiation, of these countries, how these new tactics, strategies of trying to weaken these socialist governments, such as the government of Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela. And for that, Andrea, we're going to be speaking to two experts, Ben Norton, who's a journalist, and Terry Matson, who is a political activist. But before that, right, before we start our show, we cannot start an important program like this without speaking about the burning topic of the moment.
Which is really burning, the Amazon.
Totally.
They had the burn day last week, motivated by the president of Brazil, who now called for action. But the people in New York are not standing still. Yesterday, they took to the streets, they protested, Extinction Rebellion, Partido Libre, FSLMN, all the Brazilian groups, Alerta NYC, Defend Democracy in Brazil, the women against Bolsonaro. Everybody was on the streets. They did a beautiful march where they were calling Amazon is on fire, Amazon is burning, and Bolsonaro is a liar, which is really what's happening. And that came, the G7 is getting together, and Macron in France, who is very much a neoliberal, is calling for sanctions against Brazil. So they're fighting amongst themselves because they're seeing how dangerous this is. And also about the bans that they're doing to Latin American countries, President Trump is trying to do that to American companies by doing, forcing companies out of China and forcing companies out of trade to China. So these are very hot political topics, and we need to get out and start thinking about votes, start thinking about who we represent, and move forward and change what's up there.
Absolutely. I was able to come to that protest yesterday, Andrea, from Bryant Park to the United Nations, and it was really inspiring to see so many people come out in defense of the Amazon and, you know, against Jair Bolsonaro, who is, we know, a neoliberal imperialist who is just following the dictates of Washington and whatever Trump tells him.
And he follows exactly what the government here follows, which is bullets, bovines, and the Bible. So they use the triple B politics to bring evangelicals, and under this evangelical cover, they bring motivation and to kill each other. They bring guns, and they are really against the farming. They're against the forests so that they can grow cattle.
And Andrea, you're from Brazil. You're an expert in Brazilian politics and what is happening in Brazil. And people are so alarmed. This is like shocking to everyone that, you know, a government like the one of Jair Bolsonaro can actually burn, as he is being blamed, the Amazons. And what are the economic intentions behind that? Why will Jair Bolsonaro be interested in destroying such large part of the Amazons?
Well, the export part comes with a change every day. Brazilian government is always changing, so we never know. See, the situation is, first of all, it's very hard to believe that 58 million people voted Jair Bolsonaro in. Mm-hmm. This starts with Dilma being deposed and Lula being arrested. There is an interest in making Brazil a farm of the United States. And in the Amazon right now, you already have major corporations like McDonald's growing their oranges and their beef. So there is an interest that these people have in making this land productive for the green, not the trees, but the green from dollars. And Bolsonaro has the support of these people. They were instated in government by the coup, the soft coup that happened. And Sergio Moro is completely untouchable. Lula has been sequestered from public life. And right now, it keeps on going. The absurds in Brazil, it's like the country of absurds right now. You cannot believe the politics. I mean, Lula is still in jail after car wash has been unmasked by Glenn Greenwald as absurd. You know, this man is not a danger to anybody. He is a national and international leader, and he needs to be freed if we're going to do something about Latin America and about the world being out of poverty.
The integration, too, and peace in Latin America. Andrea, we want to make sure we remind our listeners to call us in at any given moment if they have a burning desire to express a comment or ask the question to the participants. And we're going to move right on. We're going to give them the number to call in. If at any given moment they want to call, it's 212-209-2877. Please register that number, 212-209-2877, to call us in for comments or calls. I want to send cheers, Andrea, to our compañeras Cristina and Sonia from the Resistance of Brazil. I met with them yesterday, and they share how important a program like this is, and they're interested in also becoming buddies of our program, so that's like really, really cool. And they said we don't call in because we don't know when to call, so this is why I'm making sure that now we let our audience know this is the number to call in, and please share your ideas.
And call us at any time, yes, because we'll put you on hold until it's time to get you on the air, if there's time for that. So please call. Also, Lucy, in becoming a buddy, you can go to WBAI.org and give. You can text.
That's right.
41444. So become our buddy.
Or give a one-time contribution. You could do that if you love our program. Like, we've been expressed how much people are liking our program. So we're going to tune in now to our first special guest, Ben Norton. He is now waiting for us. Ben Norton is in Caracas, and he's going to be joining us. And Ben Norton is a journalist, writer, and filmmaker. He is the assistant editor of the investigative journalism website, The Gray Zone. Gray with an A, as Ben likes to say, which you can find at thegrayzone.com. And again, great spell with an A. He is also the producer and video show moderator of a video show of Moderate Rebels, which he hosts with journalist Max Blumenthal. You can find it at moderaterebels.com. But before we get Ben on the program, we want to start with a beautiful song about the resistance in Honduras, because Ben is going to share his experience. He's done a trip around Latin America this summer, and he's visited three different countries for three particular reasons. He was in Honduras on June 28th, then in Nicaragua on July the 19th, and then as we speak, he's in Caracas. So we want to start him telling us about his experience in Honduras first, then in Nicaragua, and then we're going to end it with Venezuela. So we want to start with, yes, it's called the Anthem of the Honduran Resistance, El Himno de la Resistencia. Okay? And then we're going to have Ben come on board. And once again, don't forget the number to call in if you have questions or comments, 212-209-2877.
Para nunca retroceder, para nunca dejarme amilanar por las circunstancias y los problemas, para siempre avanzar, he tenido la fe para lograr la victoria. En el centro de América un pueblo que despertó, porque marcó una senda e hizo una revolución. Ahora lo quieren callar, lo quieren sacrificar, porque a fuerza de balas le quitan su libertad. Una madrugada de gorilas y terror, secuestran al presidente y violan la constitución. Contra el golpe militar, resistencia popular, pues no podrán vencer al gran pueblo de Morazán. Honduras, el pueblo está contigo. Honduras, un pueblo que no calla. Honduras, resiste la batalla. Pa' que vuelva aquel que no te falla. Honduras, el pueblo está contigo. Honduras, pueblo que no calla.
We are back at Voices of Resistance. I am Lucy Paguada Quesada, and online we have Ben Norton, journalist from The Gray Zone. Ben, are you there with us?
Yes, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you. And I'd like to tell you that we have great reception. You're in Caracas right now?
Yes, I'm here in the center of Caracas. I've been here for a bit over a month. And of course, we'll talk about the political situation, but I can stress that everything here is fine and normal. there is peace, people are living a normal life, and whatever you see in the corporate media about Venezuela is just a ridiculous caricature of the actual normal life people are living here.
That sounds wonderful. And I'm here with my co-host, my compañera Andrea Bizeo.
Hi, Ben. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
And how is beautiful Caracas this beautiful Sunday?
Amazing. The only thing I can complain about is it's kind of hot, but otherwise, it's beautiful.
Is it feeling the heat of the Amazon? Because you guys are so close.
Well, true, but I will. One point I wanted to mention, I mean, thank you for providing the important context of the far right, I would say even fascistic Bolsonaro regime in Brazil, which is essentially allowing this fire to go on because it's profitable for those who want to deforest the Amazon. But I will say another crucial point in terms of resistance. Evo Morales, the democratically elected socialist anti-imperialist president of Bolivia, actually bought the largest super tanker made on planet Earth and has been playing a leading role in helping to extinguish those fires. And of course, there's not much coverage of this. There's a lot of coverage in the corporate media of the fires, but not of the resistance to the fires, which is being led, once again, by an indigenous, progressive, socialist, anti-imperialist leader in Bolivia.
And also Maduro has offered to support the fight against these fires, correct?
Absolutely. Venezuela has as well. So once again, we see that the U.S. allies and client states, like the fascistic Bolsonaro regime in Brazil, is the one that's actually encouraging the fire that is destroying this forest on which all human beings on planet Earth rely for oxygen. And meanwhile, these so-called fake dictatorships that the Western media tells us about, which are actually democratically elected left-wing governments, they're the ones leading the resistance to help save one of the major sources of oxygen for the entire planet. It's a perfect symbol for the actual role of the U.S. government in Latin America.
Asphyxia.
Yes, yes. And the lungs of the planet, of course. Who will lead an amazing rescue program if not President Evo Morales, our first indigenous president? We're so proud and we love him so much. And, we could talk more about this, and we are going to continue to talk about this because this is an emergency. It's an urgency. We should all get involved. But let's get back to your trips. You've been doing a lot of traveling this summer, and you started out with coming to Honduras on June 28th for the 10th anniversary of the coup. Can you first give us a scoop of how you see the situation in Honduras 10 years after the coup?
Well, what's really wild and so surreal being here in Venezuela for the past several weeks is that every lie that the U.S. corporate media and government claim about Venezuela is actually true for Honduras. Hmm. As an example, we frequently hear the Trump administration and neoconservatives like John Bolton, his national security advisor, who is helping to lead this extremely hawkish, belligerent U.S. policy against Latin America. They frequently call Venezuela, they say the government is a narco dictatorship, and they claim that the government is supporting the drug trade. Meanwhile, the U.S. client regime in Honduras of Juan Orlando Hernandez that was installed through a U.S.-backed right-wing military coup that began under Barack Obama, we should stress, not under Trump, and has continued under Trump, this government, this regime that stole the 2017 election in a rigged, stolen election that was so blatant that even the OAS, the Organization of American States, which is very right-wing and biased against the left-wing governments in the region, even the OAS admitted that the rigged 2017 election in Honduras was the dirtiest election it had ever monitored, where the Hoad regime blatantly stole the election from the obvious victor, which was the Libre Party. But even aside from all of that, a U.S. federal court in New York just a few weeks ago specifically named President Juan Orlando Hernandez in a case as a co-conspirator who used drug money to help fund his campaign in the other rigged 2013 election. So we have a U.S. court admitting that a major U.S. ally, that actually what many people in Latin America refer to as títere, a puppet, a major U.S. puppet in the region, is directly complicit in the drug trade. His brother, Tony Hernandez, is currently currently in prison because he was also smuggling drugs, and he was so blatant about it that he put his initials, TH, on the actual bags of drugs, of cocaine that he was selling. So meanwhile, you have this key U.S. ally, this key puppet in the heart of Central America, in a strategically important region, with the site of the largest U.S. military base in the region. And when we were in Honduras, my colleague Max Blumenthal and I visited the Soto Cano Palmarola Air Base, which is the largest U.S. base in all of Latin America. If you go to the gray zone, you can find a report from this base. All of these things are happening in Honduras. There have been protests going on since we were there in June, and actually since May, there have been protests being led by teachers and medical workers and students and workers against the privatization measures of the Ho regime, which is trying to privatize the very few social programs that are still public, like education and healthcare. And the police, the military police, who act as the kind of Praetorian guard of the Ho regime, they have actually been shooting protesters with live bullets. And we visited the Autonomous University of Honduras, where students were actually shot. Several students were shot with live ammunition by these military police that violated the autonomy of the university. So all of this violence, all of this repression, this corruption, this drug dealing is happening in one of the closest U.S. allies, one of the closest U.S. client states in the region, in Honduras. There is no functioning democracy there. And meanwhile, in Venezuela, the corporate media claims all of those lies about Venezuela when none of them are true here. So once again, we see not just hypocrisy, but projection, where the U.S. government and the corporate media that acts as a handmaiden and a stenographer, always echoing the government, all of the lies they say about Honduras, or about Venezuela rather, are projection for what the U.S.'s own allies are doing in the region.
Exactly. And Honduras is a perfect example of what can happen to a country, compañero Ben, when the democratic process is destroyed with a coup, as they are trying to do in these other countries like Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, to literally establish these puppet administrations of Washington. These are the puppets of Washington. And now the new modality is narco states. And this is what the United States government is supporting in our countries with our tax money. And that's the message that we want to let the average American person know. This is being done with our tax money.
And it's ridiculous how much alike the coup in Honduras and the coup in Brazil is. The president of Brazil, his airplane, got caught with 79, I think, kilos of cocaine about 2 months ago in Europe. So the narco traffic is there, you know, and it's the same model. These people have no brain. They follow U.S. model. They are trained here in the U.S. And their only agenda is to make this place a slave farm for the United States.
Exactly. And Ben, in your visit with the crew of the Gray Zone in Honduras, which I followed very closely, and I thank you for the work that you all did there, you were able to meet with President Zelaya. You were able to interview him. And can you give us a scoop of what that experience was like, and what can we as Americans take from your interview with President Zelaya?
Well, a lot of things. And one point, I'm really glad that you mentioned the case in Brazil, because what's really wild to me as a journalist is that story of dozens of kilograms of cocaine being found on Bolsonaro's private plane. After one day, it just disappeared from the media, which is an example of the corporate media's role as a functional arm of Western governments, where there are certain stories they just bury overnight because it's inconvenient for the national security state. It's inconvenient for multinational corporations that are working with the Bolsonaro regime and that want to control the Venezuelan economy but can't because there's an independent socialist government here. So it's just a great example of that hypocrisy. But to answer your question, absolutely. I will say that President Zelaya, he's very impressive, and it's not even just him as a person. The resistance movement in Honduras is so strong and impressive. And I'm not just saying that, of course, because I'm on this program. I mean, genuinely, I can say that, you know, I've been to a lot of countries in Latin America. Unfortunately, the progressive resistance movements in some other countries is not strong. So, for instance, I was in Colombia in April reporting on the crisis of assassinations there. Colombia has the highest rate of assassinations of activists out of the entire world, worse than Brazil, worse than Mexico, where every year there are an average around 200 human rights activists who are murdered. And the resistance movement there has been very repressed and crushed. And of course, this is another major U.S. ally. It's another U.S.-backed regime that is deeply, deeply implicated in the drug trade. So Honduras is a positive example where the resistance movement is thriving and where the regime is extremely unpopular. And I actually have video that I still need to publish. I'll do that soon at the Gray Zone. But what was really wild is one day we were meeting President Zelaya outside of the headquarters of the Libre Party in Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras. And we were just standing outside, and Zelaya, who, by the way, drives his own car, and he was driving his car with his mother. They don't have bulletproof vests. They don't have security with them. I mean, it's very impressive, and it's very dangerous for him, but it shows how much he believes in his people. And while we were standing outside of the headquarters, I kid you not, three different cars stopped because people driving by recognized Zelaya, and they got out of their car. They stopped in the middle of the road and came up to him and said, "President Zelaya, thank you so much for all of the work you're doing. We love you." It was surreal for me because I had heard people talk about that, but I kind of thought it was hyperbole. People were exaggerating. But I saw it with my own eyes happen three times in the span of 20 minutes. So it's a true sign that Manuel Zelaya is a popular leader that is beloved by the population. And also he's part of a much larger movement. The movement led by the Libre Party and also other social movements and other groups is a massive movement. So not just the Libre Party, for instance, my colleagues and I visited the home of Berta Cáceres. People listening might know this name. She was a renowned feminist and environmental activist who was murdered by paramilitary forces hired by an international, multinational corporation, but that were trained by the state security forces that were also trained by the U.S. government. So there
and
are
this
links
is
to
under
the
Juan Orlando administration.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The narco.
And we visited the home of Berta Cáceres. We interviewed her mother, which we're going to publish that interview as well at the Gray Zone. And we also interviewed her, two of her daughters, one of whom is a representative from the Libre Party, and talked to them about the resistance in this small town, La Esperanza, in rural Honduras. So it's an example that in all sectors of society, there is resistance against extreme oppression, even though there are many people being killed and oppressed and political prisoners. And finally, I'll say one other important anecdote. When we were there in Honduras, we visited a small town called Retoca, which is an indigenous community where another multinational corporation that is partially owned by an Italian and a Chilean company is going to destroy this river inside Retoca that the indigenous community relies on to survive. And of course, this is not going to benefit average Hondurans. This is not a national developmental project. This is for international corporations so they can exploit this country. And we interviewed some of the indigenous leaders talking about how their entire families and communities are going to be destroyed and displaced because of this project. So there's so much happening, but at the same time, there's so much resistance going on in Honduras. And of all of the countries I've been in Latin America, I actually came out of Honduras, despite the problems, being the most optimistic out of all the countries I've been in because the resistance is so strong and continues to grow.
And Ben, yes, we're very lucky to have a leader. I think that part of the success of the Honduran resistance, the permanence, the strength of it, has to do with the fact that we have a leader that is dear for the people, that is willing to sacrifice everything. And, you know, his family, his son, wealth, President Zelaya. And the resistance is organized nationally, but also internationally, because there is so much resistance outside of Honduras, too. And we know that the narco government of Juan Orlando Hernández is very weak, and is the result of everything that the resistance does in Honduras as well as outside of Honduras. So we feel very privileged about that. I know that Andrea wants to comment or have a question.
Well, my question to you, Ben, it has to do with the indigenous people of Mexico, of Honduras, of Brazil. Anybody that has defended water are necessarily being likened to die. And we're talking about the Amazon, but we're not having this major discussion, which is the water and the planet. When you travel, especially throughout Honduras, looking at the example of Berta Cáceres, for instance, what can we talk to us about that? What did you see with these major enterprises trying to capitalize on water, on fresh water?
Well, you hit the nail on the head. Any human rights activists, environmental activists, indigenous activists who are trying to protect water and land from exploitation by multinational corporations, any of these activists is portrayed as a threat, even a terrorist in some cases. And actually, it's not even just something in Latin America. We saw the same thing happen with indigenous peoples in the United States, where we saw at Standing Rock, you saw indigenous communities trying to defend the sovereignty of their land against multinational fossil fuel companies that want to destroy their communities so they can make money and earn profit. So we see that this is an example of a larger international problem, because capitalism is an international system, and the only thing that is important in capitalism is the bottom line, is profits, is money. And these capitalist governments, their main function, their main goal in society is to serve the interests of those capitalists who fund their electoral campaigns, who give them money, and who want to exploit these natural resources. So, unfortunately, this is not some isolated incident. This is something that is happening throughout the world. And that's why it's so important for us, you know, for me as a U.S. citizen, for you two as internationals living in the United States as well. It's so important for all of us to link our struggles together, because they all have the same roots in the same capitalist and imperialist system.
Ben, for those listeners who just tune in, you're listening to Voices of Resistance at WBAI 99.5 FM. I am Lucy Paguada, and we are having a great discussion today with our special guest, Ben Norton, a journalist from The Gray Zone. We're going to move from this segment, and we are going to tune in to our next topic, which is Nicaragua and your experience there. But before that, before we move to speaking about Nicaragua, we're going to listen to a beautiful song by two national artists from Nicaragua, Luis and Carlos Mejía Godoy. And the song is titled Yo Soy de un Pueblo Pequeño. I am from a very small town. Let's listen, please. Thank you.
Yo soy de un pueblo pequeño, pequeño como un gorrión, con medio siglo de sueños, de vergüenza y de valor. Yo soy de un pueblo sencillo como la palabra Juan, como el amor que yo entrego, como el amor que me dan. Yo soy de un pueblo nacido entre fusil y cantar, que de tanto haber sufrido tiene mucho que enseñar. Hermano de tantos pueblos que han querido separar, porque saben que aún pequeños juntos somos un volcán. Porque saben que aún pequeños juntos somos un volcán.
Música.
Yo soy de un pueblo que es poeta y sus versos escribió en los muros y en las puertas con sangre, rabia y amor. Yo soy de un pueblo orgulloso con mil batallas perdidas. Soy de un pueblo victorioso que aún le duelen las heridas. Yo soy de un pueblo nacido entre fusil y cantar, que de tanto haber sufrido tiene mucho que enseñar. Hermano de tantos pueblos que han querido separar, porque saben que aún pequeños juntos somos un volcán. Porque saben que aún pequeños juntos somos un.
We are back with our very special program and our very special guest, Ben Norton from The Gray Zone. Once again, we want to encourage our listeners to please call us in if you have questions or comments. The number is 212-209-2877, and we would love to hear if you have comments or if you have questions. And Ben, we are back, and you have been traveling, as I said before, throughout Latin America. You started in Honduras, and then on the week of July 19th, you visited Nicaragua to participate in the extraordinary celebration of the 40th anniversary of the triumph of the Sandinista Revolution over the bloody dictator Anastasio Somoza. And so, Ben, Nicaragua has been under the radar of the Washington imperialist
machine.
Trump administration. Yes,
the Washington machine is how I call it.
Yes, the killing machine. Along with Cuba and Venezuela. In fact, Donald Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton, calls these three socialist countries the troika of tyranny, they say. And, yeah, right, it's to laugh off. And on April of last year, Nicaragua was a victim of an attempted failed U.S. coup. How do you see the current situation in Nicaragua based on your experience there?
Well, Nicaragua is an example of, I mentioned this powerful resistance in Honduras, but imagining that actually governing society. In Nicaragua, the Sandinista front is extremely popular throughout many segments of society. Now, Nicaragua is also a divided society, and it reminds me kind of Venezuela, where there is a small segment of the population, I would say around 15 to 20%, maybe one-fifth of the population, that consists of the elites that used to govern society, and they are basically at permanent war with the elected government. And so there still are these divisions within society. It's the same thing here in Venezuela. The former oligarchs who live in the eastern part of Caracas, who work with international financial institutions like the World Bank, they want to come back into governance, and it's the same thing in Nicaragua.
It's the turnout, the haves versus the have-nots. That's
exactly
the conflict. Now, and Ben, we have a caller that we wanted to bring on the air. Caller, are you there? Please identify yourself. Hello?
I'd like to get on the air.
Oh, hello? Go ahead.
Hello? I'd like to get on the air.
Yes, you're here.
Pardon?
You go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just want to remark, regardless of...
Please identify yourself, sir.
Oh, my name is Jose. I just want to say, regardless of who becomes, a politician who comes to power, you still have the issue of neoliberalism. You know, so regardless, you know, if it's Lula or it's... against Bolsonaro, it comes down to, who's the power of corporate power, global capitalism.
Yes, and do you have a question for our guest, Ben Norton?
No, that's the question I want to ask. How do you deal with the issues of neoliberalism that's gone on in this here in the States for about over 40 years and gone throughout Latin America since the 1970s, since the coup in Chile that brought Pinochet to power.
1973. Of course. Yeah. Ben, you heard the question, right?
Yeah,
go
it's
ahead.
A very
Thank
good question.
You.
Yes. Thank you for that. I will say that it's a reflection of the fact that many of these governments in the region are only doing what they can within the confines of this global neoliberal system. It's a very crucial point. So as an example, the gains of the revolution in Nicaragua, we shouldn't downplay them. Nicaragua has free public education at all levels, free public socialized health care. And my colleague Max Blumenthal actually, unfortunately, had personal experience with this because he got very sick and he passed out and cracked his head open and had to go to the emergency room. And he immediately got stitches with no wait for free in the hospital, which would have cost thousands of dollars in a U.S. hospital. So those are important gains, of course, and also the mobilization of women in Nicaraguan society. At the same time, the point that you make is really important, that Nicaragua is still functioning within a global neoliberal system, and it's a very tiny country, and it's very hard to develop productive forces when you're facing the fact that you have to finance things, you have to get access to capital, you have to get access to loans, and the international institutions that allow the access to that capital and that financing are neoliberal institutions like the World Bank and the IMF.
The first thing they're going after are people's pensions and public health systems. Like, for instance, in Brazil, that's completely destroyed right now. There's no more retirement, there's no more social services as it is. And Brazil had a model public service in health, and it's being dismantled as we speak.
Well, of course, it's also a reflection of the fact that the U.S. government always claims that Nicaragua is they say it's a communist regime. Actually, the policies implemented by the Sandinista Front are social democratic policies because that's all that it can do operating within this international neoliberal system, and especially facing U.S. sanctions and the threat of more sanctions from international financial institutions. So the answer to the question, the short answer, is that in order to combat neoliberalism, that has to be done in the heart of the imperial core. It has to be done in the U.S., in Britain, in Europe, and it has to be done against these larger international institutions like the IMF and the World Bank and the Bretton Woods financial system, because those are the international arbiters that keep in place this neoliberal system. And the small countries in the global south that are resisting are only doing as much as they can domestically, but there has to be an international movement against the center of neoliberal power in the global north.
Totally. And as we speak, and you reference to what is going on in Honduras with the doctors and the teachers, this is their front fight right now against the privatization of these very last institutions that are today public and that neoliberals just want to crash down in Honduras. How do you see the fight against neoliberalism in Venezuela? Because we know that's like the epicenter of this brutal fight against what Washington is trying to do there.
And a motto of resistance. Yes. We need to praise it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I will say it's very difficult. And it's an example of what I was saying, that the neoliberal system is maintained by the centers of power in the imperialist global north countries, mainly the U.S. and Britain, but also to a lesser extent other parts of Europe, France, Germany. They're all part of this international neoliberal system that is maintained through the Bretton Woods financial system that was created after World War II. And it's a kind of neocolonial system. And Venezuela is an example of how a country can resist against that, but is still facing the material limitations of that system. Venezuela has done so much, but now it is facing a complete U.S. embargo. The Trump administration on August 5th declared a complete blockade of this country. There was already a de facto blockade, but now it's official, it's on paper. And what that means is not only that no U.S. companies can do business with the Venezuelan government, not only that, but any international company, institution, or government body that wants to do business with the Venezuelan government is now facing threats of secondary sanctions from the U.S. government. And of course, the United States is still the largest economy in the world, so international institutions don't want to do business with Venezuela if they're facing the threat of sanctions. We saw, for instance, Turkey's largest bank had to close its account with the Venezuelan Central Bank because of the threats of U.S. sanctions. Even a Chinese oil company was forced to stop doing business with Venezuela. So Venezuela is a great example of the resistance, but at the same time, it's being very greatly oppressed, and these sanctions and this economic war are hurting the entire population. The U.S. government, This began under Obama and has been greatly expanded under Trump. It's a bipartisan economic war, and it's a war on the entire Venezuelan population, not just the government. It's hurting everyone, and the United States is trying to use hunger as a weapon. And the final thing I'll say is that a recent study by two world-renowned economists, Jeffrey Sachs and Mark Weisbrot, found that because of the sanctions, in less than 2 years, in 2017 and 2018, the U.S. sanctions led to the preventable excess deaths of at least 40,000 Venezuelans. And that's a conservative estimate. So these sanctions are killing huge numbers of civilians in Venezuela. And the government is holding on. But because of this economic warfare and these international institutions, there's only so much it can do.
That's very similar to the Cuban embargo, which is genocidal at best, you know. And but we're bringing on Terry Matson that's going to be talking to us about that. We wanted to ask you as we wrap up to just briefly tell us, how do people find out about the Gray Zone? How do we support investigative journalism? And we want to bring you back soon.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me, and thank you for this important show. I mean, it's very important to talk about these issues that are totally ignored in the English language corporate media, and for that matter, a lot of the Spanish language corporate media. And that's why we created the Gray Zone. It's an independent platform for investigative journalism, exposing imperialism, exposing these corporate crimes. And you can find it at thegrayzone.com. That's Grayzone with an A. And you can find me at Twitter, at Benjamin Norton, and keep track of the work we're doing. We have a lot more coming, and thanks for having me.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. We'll keep in touch, and we'll invite you again. And greetings to our people in Caracas, in Venezuela, all of Latin America, and power to the people. Thank you, Ben. Thank you. We are now going to move to one more song. It's called Perdóneme, Tío Juan, and it's a song by Los Guaraguao, a national group from Venezuela, as we turn into our next and last guest, Terry Matson.
Perdóneme, tío Juan, pero se ve que no sabe nada. Las cosas que yo le digo se sienten en carne propia. En tierra venezolana, el imperialismo yanqui hace lo que les da la gana. Y es que usted no se ha paseado por un campo petrolero. Usted no ve que se llevan lo que es de nuestra tierra y solo nos van dejando miseria y sudor de obrero. Y solo nos van dejando miseria y sudor de obrero. Los niñitos más silentos que habitan allá en los cerros.
Hello, everybody. We are on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm Andrea Vizio here with my friend and companheira Lucy Paguada Quesada, and our favorite, Sean, the best. We are bringing on Terry Matson, that's calling from Washington, D.C. Terry was introduced to Mesoamerican anthropology and archaeology in the sixth grade. Since then, her lifelong passion for Latin America has inspired over 35 years of travel to the region. The last few years include organizing and participating in political and social justice delegations to Cuba, Ecuador, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Mexico, Nicaragua, Venezuela. It's missing Brazil, Terry. Terry recently returned from the Foro de São Paulo, Caracas, and prior to beginning her position in Code Pink, she spent the early part of 2019 leading an anti-sanctions campaign delegation to Venezuela. And she remained in Venezuela for about 3 months. She's the founder and coordinator of the campaign to end U.S. and Canada sanctions against Venezuela. Terry, welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me this afternoon.
So
where would you like me to start? I mean, Ben did a terrific job, and maybe we could have even had him stay on the air with us, yeah?
I know.
I'm so pleased I saw him in Caracas last month, and I'm so pleased he was able to stay longer, because I can, you know, share with you and your listeners that, you know, an extended stay in Venezuela is so necessary to understand the the narrative we are being fed here in the U.S.
I know. We wanted to give you both a lot of time. It feels like we could do the whole afternoon having this conversation.
What a great show.
What we needed to do, I think, for the sake of time, talk to us about the campaign you're leading. Also talk to us about Code Pink. And
great.
And one more thing. And build on the sanctions that Ben was talking about, please. And if you could talk also about Cuba in that conversation.
And Nicaragua, because they're all under attack.
And Nicaragua, too, and about 30 other countries that are suffering varying degrees of financial sanctions imposed by the U.S. Can I just say something real quick that one of you brought up about water rights and control of the water?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
This is something that, and not just water, but natural resources in general, this is something that the continent of the Americas has suffered the last 500 years. This is not anything new. I think those of you from Central South America and the Caribbean are acutely aware of that. Those of us in North America need to grasp a better understanding that this is not anything new, control of natural resources. Sometimes it's colonialism, imperialism, neoliberal capitalism, but it's not a new paradigm. And since we're talking about Venezuela, we just say about a year ago, I heard a terrific talk. I think he gave it in India, actually. The foreign minister of Venezuela, Jorge Arriaza, gave a terrific talk on natural resource sovereignty, not only national sovereignty, but natural resource sovereignty. And so much of this we see playing out in Venezuela as a flashpoint. And my personal experience would say the control of those natural resources is really so much of what the sanctions are being imposed on Venezuela. It's a really their choice as to who they want to extract those resources. Is it U.S.? Is it transnational corporations? Is it other allies that they're with? And the U.S. is trying to prevent that on all levels. And as Ben had said, these sanctions, they're targeted at government leaders and at some businesses, and now at people doing business with government-owned businesses. And it's just rippled out to this huge, heinous form of warfare.
I feel it's a little bigger than that even, Terry. It's about the sovereignty of these countries. There's a reason why Lula is in jail. There's a reason why they tried to overthrow Maduro. It's because these people defended national sovereignty. They defended their soil, they defended their nature, and they defended their people.
The land.
And poverty is a big business. You know,
yes, it is.
Poverty is a big business, and we need to denounce it. People are making money out of the poor people, and then the idea is to call them lazy. The idea is to give them a hand-me-down and say, oh, they don't do enough. And that's not what we're talking about. These countries are sovereign, and what the United States is trying to do and does is directly interfere on the autonomy of the people of other countries. And this has to stop.
Well, we see that all over the world. And, you know, in my lifetime, probably about 70 attempts here in our own hemisphere. And so let me just share with you a few things that I lived through earlier this year under sanctions. And, of course, they weren't as severe earlier this year as they are now, as of August 5. I lived in a neighborhood in Caracas, a politically mixed working class neighborhood of Caracas. So the household I was in is Chavista, but a good percentage of the neighborhood is also opposition, although not wealthy opposition that would relate to Guaido and his 1% wealthy business, you know, demographic. These people were just basically didn't ever really support Chavismo from the early days, not particularly against a Chavista government, but that's just not their personal affiliation with politics. So here I was living for 3 months among people who, when the power went out, we were on some rolling blackouts for energy rationing right after the national power outage, and the government was, you know, in the process of getting everything back online across the country. And in order to do that, they had to manage, you know, who got how much electricity for certain hours of days of the week. And it worked pretty well, that management program. But there were days, you know, where we were lacking electricity maybe half the day, and there was nobody in the neighborhood who was screaming anything against the current government. People came together regardless of political affiliation and helped with childcare, helped with meals if they had a gas stove instead of an electric stove, and you saw a lot of community organizing despite politics.
Okay, the community organizing. Talk to us one thing, like what are they doing in terms of the
they
sanction?
Are helping.
Do they call it out? Do they label it what it is? Do people know what's going on?
Particularly with the national power outage, it was pretty much identified as a U.S. cyber attack. I mean, people were very overt in that conversation. People understand that this is warfare from the north. They understand the wealth of their country, and not just the natural resources, but the human resources of their country as well. And they clearly understand it. And my experience would lead, you know, shows how much they are willing to work together despite politics, which you do not hear in the States. We are under the impression that there's a definitive line between the political demographics. There isn't. People are perfectly capable of working together through these issues, and they are. And that I can't stress the importance of that. That people are working together.
And how about the campaign here to support those people? Because right now we are having these people being badgered by the sanctions. And you organize, you're in Washington. What can we do? What can be done to do reverse this tide? We got to stop this, no?
Well, I think you mentioned earlier it's a form of genocide, and it basically is an attempt to destabilize the country, at the very least to get the population to flee, if not create a civil war among themselves and overthrow the current government. That's very clear. And people there understand that on both sides, that is the attempt. And I would say it's made them all Venezuelans first and political parties second. And it's a really wonderful thing to see. Here in the States, we need to do a better job of understanding how sanctions, and I think the better term to use is unilateral coercive measures, how they're being used as a form of warfare. People, those of us here in North America tend to think, well, we're not dropping bombs on Venezuela. We don't have troops on the ground in Venezuela. How bad can it be? Well, this is an attempt at genocide of the entire population. That's how bad it is. This is a form of warfare. I think the term that analysts are using now is hybrid warfare. So sanctions is one form of a non-hot war. So here at home, we have started a year ago, actually, and we've done a number of significant projects in the last 12 months.
We have about a minute left. So
people can go to the Campaign to End U.S. and Canada Sanctions, and that's at afgj.org and at codepink.org, and see. There's a lot of reference materials there to understand how the sanctions are being used and how devastating they are, and request to join our campaign. We are looking at expanding the coalition that we're working with, principally because, and I know you mentioned this Center for Economic Policy and Research report in the first part of this program. There's also a report out by Francisco Rodriguez about the negative effects of sanctions. And this is a really important report.
But we're going to have to laugh.
That he worked for the opposition. So.
Okay. We wanted to thank you so much for joining us, Terry. And we're going to invite you to come back. This has been wonderful. It was very nice to have both you and shout out to Ben from Venezuela.
We need more time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you so much. We'll stay in tune and follow the work, the amazing work that you and Ben are doing. And until next time, okay? Thank you so much. We want to invite our listeners to tune in to La Voz Latina, which is coming at 2 p.m. And thanks to our listeners of Voices of Resistance at WBAI 99.5 FM New York. Real analysis from the real front lines of struggle here and abroad. We thank our support tech person, compañero Sean Rhodes, and our program director, Linda Perry, for her trust. Until next Sunday at 2 p.m.
Resist.
Soy, Soy lo que dejaron, soy toda la sobra de lo que se robaron. Un pueblo escondido en la cima, mi piel es de cuero, por eso aguanta cualquier clima. Soy una fábrica de humo, mano de obra campesina para tu consumo. Frente de frío en el medio del verano, el amor en los tiempos del cólera, mi hermano. El sol que nace y el día que muere, con los mejores atardeceres. Soy el desarrollo en carne viva, un discurso político sin saliva.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. And I'm